Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue, and I'm an author, a journalist, and an unfinished biography of W.B. Yeats. Joining me is best-selling author and star of the hit TV series Three Men Went to Mo, Kathy Kelly.
Yeah, I wish I had been in Three Men Went to Mo, because it sounded, it sounded very, very interesting. Yeah.
So, right. So much of the shows in this book sound like they'd be great, you know? Well,
some of them sounded absolutely hilarious, because I got into... Rivals. I'm trying to think when I read it. I mean, when was it? Was it 86?
Oh, probably. I think it was, mid-80s it came out.
It was mid-80s. And it was, I would have been still in, actually, I was just getting into journalism because I would have been finishing journalism college for which I have a certificate.
Oh, well.
The whole certificate. And, but, you know, it was very journalistic, but the plots in it. I mean, there was one thing called Master Dog, which was finding, you know, the cleverest
the
dog
smartest
ever.
Dog in England.
The smartest dog in England. And I kept thinking of a thing at the time with Esther Ranson called That's Life, and they had a dog that could say, sausages. So you're far too young for this, but I was really into that sort of stuff, but yeah.
Wow, it really was then that was the golden age of television.
Yeah,
you know?
The generation game.
We're fooling ourselves with like... you know, Succession and Game of Thrones and all this. This was the golden age.
This was the golden age. Oh, no, but Game of Thrones. Oh, my God, it's just fantastic. I only came to the party recently. It is amazing. Anyway, we're not talking about Game of Thrones. Winter is not coming.
Rivals, yes. Yeah. What's your relationship with Rivals and with Jilly Cooper?
I always loved Jilly Cooper. I remember getting when Riders came out, I remember being given a copy of it by a friend. And it was the most amazing thing I'd ever read because it was just so big and beautiful and fabulous. And it was about people and there were characters you liked and there were characters you didn't like. And then when Rivals came out, it had that journalistic hint and it had among so many heroes and heroines. And that is one of the amazing things that Jilly does is she creates so many characters. But she had this... wonderful Declan, who is this Irish megastar TV person.
Yeah.
And he was just fabulous. He was this tall, craggy, amazing man with a fabulous voice. And you can think of so many people who sort of he fits, but she created people who were just totally individual. And I just loved it. There were so many things going on. I'll have to stop using the word so here. Jilly would be ashamed. But when I worked in journalism, I interviewed Jilly.
I was wondering if you had a Jilly story.
We all have our Jilly stories. And even though my newspaper, The Sunday World, didn't really have a books page at all, I wangled my way into meeting her in the Shelburne. And she was so lovely. And she was wearing a lovely necklace with one of her dogs. I think it was Barbara, painted on a little necklace around her neck. And I'm exactly the way she is about dogs. I'm like totally dog mad, animal mad. And then we are now represented by the same agents. And I've met her at a couple of parties. Now, I will only say I have met her and the woman, you know, glorious Jilly. I'm sure she couldn't pick me out of a lineup. But it's just, she's just so lovely to everyone. She was gorgeous to me. She was gorgeous to the person bringing in the tea. She was just the epitome of a beautiful, beautiful human being. And it annoys me so much when people interview her and then decide that they're going to rip her apart because she writes books that lots of people like to read.
Mm-hmm.
And that
cardinal sin.
Yeah, that's a cardinal sin because if lots of people like to read it, it must be dreadful. But Rivals just, I don't know, just pinged so many bells. And it changed the Rupert Campbell Black story a little bit.
Yes.
I know, because up to that, in Riders, he was...
A sadist, really.
Well, he was a sadist and he was a bit of a bastard. So you admired him, but you knew he was very, very tough. And suddenly in this book, you see this softer side of him because he begins to fall in love with this beautiful... And of course, this sounds wrong. We have just been talking about the Thornbirds, which is a whole other story. He falls in love with the sort of 18/19-year-old daughter of... someone with whom he is pitching for an independent broadcast to have a TV company. But she is just this wonderful person who is dyslexic and tall and beautiful and is a chef. And it's just, you see him in a different light.
And it's so romantic.
Yes.
In a way that actually Riders wasn't. Like, Riders was full of sex, full of horses, full of competition, full of backstabbing and betrayal. But there actually not a lot of romance in Riders, because you had Rupert and Helen, who were just, from the beginning, it's never going to work out.
Yes.
Tori and
Gypsy Jake,
who is a marriage of convenience, even though there's a lot of affection there. Yeah. Fenella and Dino, you don't really care about.
No, you don't really care. I mean, there's some great stuff there, but you don't. Yeah, you don't.
But there's no romance that you would die for. There's no run to the airport romance. And that happens in Rivals,
yes,
you know?
It's just so special. And she writes it in a way that sort of the age is not important. So you have lovely Taggy, who originally... She is Declan, this Irish megastar, who is a megastar in British TV, and he comes to this Carinium TV in the Cotswolds, and he and his wife Maud, who is, to him, she is like a Maud Gonne figure was to Yeats.
Yeah.
We were talking about Yeats earlier. And she is beautiful, but utterly uninterested in his career, in a way to sort of say, you may be a megastar, but not to me, darling. And so that's how she holds
them. And that's a dynamic I recognise. I've seen in people. Because, you know, when you work in the media, you know, through various important, successful people, and people whose partners are very deliberately uninterested in their work and uninterested in the fandom that surrounds them. It's very common, I think.
Do you know what? It's fascinating, because she gets people so wonderfully. I think... You know, this whole area of, and I know I keep harping back to this, but the difference between, you know, popular fiction and literary fiction, and in popular fiction, you know, you know people and you see their lives and you can fall in love with them as human beings, not as romantic heroes or heroines, but you fall in love with them as people. And, you know, with literary fiction, you're perhaps not supposed to do that. It's supposed to be some commentary on life, which, of course... You know, all books, I feel, are a commentary on life, except perhaps the 50 Shades of Grey series, which is a commentary on, I don't know, whips, where you get them, how you get a room like that set up.
It's a commentary on things a woman will do to marry into money.
That's
50 Shades isn't about desire or love or kink, even, really. It's about what a woman will do for a millionaire.
And also how a man should really be getting a lot of psychoanalysis. But that's a whole other story there. But, you know, Jilly's books, she analyses people so perfectly. And you see it, you know, there is that perfect psychoanalysis of everyone. Oh. And it's done so beautifully, in a way that Maeve Binchy always did it. Mm. You know, that way of analysing people, it makes sense. You understand perfectly why they are doing this thing, because the trail right back to the cradle is there. You see the roots of whatever their behaviour is. And that is absolutely spectacular.
And do you know what? We're talking about your literary fiction versus commercial fiction kind of thing. And not to poo-poo literary fiction, because I love it. And I love both of these kinds of books.
Me too. I love them both,
hugely.
Too.
But with literary fiction, you'll often get, you know, a 300-page book that is about one person's struggle through from cradle to grave, whatever. But with a Jilly Cooper novel and many other novels like this, you'll get 60 of these characters, and with a single line, like Valerie Jones, I know so much about Valerie Jones that's off the page, you know?
You do completely. I mean, these wonderful lines, you know, she weighs herself in the morning and she's 8.5 stone on the scale, and, you know, Lizzie says, you know, whatever, and 8 of it is ego. I don't know, it's amazing. Yeah. I can remember these lines. Monica,
who was a head girl at school and remained so the rest of her life, you know?
Yes.
It's like, I know, even if Monica never showed up again, I would know who that woman was, you know?
You completely do, and the skill of that. Like, speaking as a writer, I mean, I've just written, I know this sounds very pluggy, but I don't mean it to, but, you know, my 20th novel, and I sit there and I go, I can be, like so many other writers, you know, seat of the pants. It's like I know the beginning of the journey, and I know the middle of the journey, and I know the end of the journey. But where it goes from there, it is a complete, wow, who knows? But with Gilly, you feel that she's, and maybe that's why the books take 3 years to write. And please, they shouldn't really take 3 years to write. Gilly, hurry up. But there is this beautiful plotting, this amazing ability to bring people in. I mean, I imagine in her lovely study at the end of her garden, she must have this spectacular board, or maybe she keeps it all in her head. I don't know how she... I actually, as a writer, do not know how she does
it. I would love
it.
To see... I kind of imagine a sort of a board full of post-it notes kind of thing, because
yes.
These threads that just kind of get lost for a while, and you kind of go, has she totally forgotten about that character? And then they'll just weave back in, and...
And it makes perfect sense. In a way, it reminds me of J.K. Rowling, who's a wonderful person to listen to the Harry Potter on Audible. I'm a great fan of listening to books, and I listen to favorites.
Oh, I listen to a lot of this one, actually. It's very well done, so I recommend...
Who read it?
No idea, but she knows what she's doing.
She does the voices. But, you know, I was listening to Elizabeth Jane Howard, the Cazalet, or Cazalet. I'm never entirely sure how to pronounce that. The Cazalet. How many were there? Five. And when I'm listening to that, you know, that's so beautiful. And I'll go over and I'll listen to things again and again and again. And then I'll get a new one and I'll plonk that in. But at the moment, I'm going, oh, I think I'll listen to Harry Potter again. And it's, you know, there are little snippets. I'm on the first book now, and there's a snippet, and you know that that is going to make sense later on. And you go, that's actually spectacular. It is.
And do you know what, actually? Sorry, this is a complete sidebar about Harry Potter, which we'll never cover on this podcast, because it's been covered too many places before. But I was in a similar situation recently where I was in this kind of holiday cottage, and the first Harry Potter was there, and I just kind of read it in bed one
morning. High speed, yes.
At high speed.
I know.
So readable. But I remember she got flack years later for kind of post-rationally saying that Dumbledore was gay, and been like, she said, oh, there's no evidence of it in the text. Literally on page 12, fucking, or whatever, Harry gets the card from the chocolate frog that says, you know, Nicholas Flamel, whose partner, Albus Dumbledore, whose partner of many years, Albus Dumbledore. And obviously we're led to presume that it's like a magical partner, but there's absolutely nothing to say that...
That it is not...
He wasn't just a lover, you know?
Not the case. Absolutely. I agree with you completely. And, you know, I think that was in the back of her head all along.
All the time. I don't think all she... Along. I think she has post-rationalised things since, but I don't think that was ever post-rationalised.
No, I don't think that... Absolutely, I agree completely. So I just think there's amazing skill in you know, in writers like this. And it's just... I adore them, and I relish them. And then sometimes I sit there and I go, oh, blasted, no. I can't do that. I should... Although nowadays it has to be said, and we were discussing this before we started taping, about the idea of the 80s and people discovering package holidays. This is your wonderful point. And going off, you know, and you need... There was no internet, so there was no Kindle, and you couldn't get books, you know, books
abroad.
Just
had to have the one book, and it had to be very long.
It had to be very long, I know. And... actually, I remember going on a wonderful trip to Corfu with a friend of mine and bringing Wild Swans. I had Wild Swans and she had Jackie Collins. And Wild Swans was just absolutely spectacular, and both my sons have just read it. But I can remember Wild Swans in the way that I can't remember, because obviously I finished and then I had to move on to the Jackie Collins. But I can't...
A good way around to do it, actually.
Yes, possibly. But I can't remember.
Main course,
the
then dessert.
Yeah. And I loved the Jackie Collins, but I wouldn't want to read that again. Whereas, you know, Wild Swans, I would... But that was it. They were big books, because now books are getting shorter. And in case people are thinking, you know, why is that? Are writers getting lazier? It's just that readers are used to smaller bites. So we are doing smaller books too.
Totally. And now, I don't know if you're on Instagram, but you'll see...
Oh, I love Instagram.
it's a much softer equivalent, isn't it?
Yes.
But you see people going away with their holiday reading, and it's... five books, and they'll be, you know, 3 centimetres wide. I'm going to bring us back to Rivals by just doing a quick plot summary, and then we're going to just have at it with all the various bits and pieces from this book. So, when TV star Declan O'Hara moves to Rutshire with his glamorous intellectual family, he is all set to become the celebrity interview of the decade for Corinium Television. He soon butts heads with Corinium's satanic boss, Tony Baddingham. Literally... the most bad guy name in the world, and his protege, the fierce Cameron Cook. After a rocky start, Tony and Declan part ways as sworn enemies, and Declan teams up with the local show jumping celebrity and Tory MP Rupert Campbell Black to create a rival production company and win Caridium's franchise. Meanwhile, Rupert finds himself slowly falling in love for the first time with Declan's daughter, Taggy, turning over a new leaf in the process. So I think those are the two main plots, but there are obviously affairs galore, betrayals galore, you
they
know.
There are so many hilarious bits that go on. Yes, interestingly, I have a very, very early edition of Rivals, and it's Tony Bullingham, which I think shades of the Bullingham Club in
Oh, and then
Oxford.
And she changed it from Bullingham to Baddingham.
Yes, I think so.
Fascinating.
Yes, I think so. That says something. And yes, he keeps his office very, 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 very hot, and he frightens people so that when he walks past, they all flatten themselves up against the Hessian covered walls. When I was younger, I used to have, you know, Total Recall, and I sadly do not anymore, but there are lines from books that just ping into my head. But he's you know, sort of both, he's a wonderful villain, and he has his he's having an extramarital affair with this fabulous woman called Cameron, and she's sort of voracious and she's tough, but really she's a very soft heart. And he brings her over and he's having an affair with her, and meanwhile he is married to Monica, who, you know, was the head girl and shall remain so all her life. And of course there is plenty of sex, in that, you know, he is allowed into her bed, you know, once a week, and apparently gets an enormous thrill out of this. I think there's possibly less actual sex than there is in Riders.
It tends to be that, like, people's first time together is documented very well.
Yes.
But then after that, it's more like sexual situations. It's like naked playing tennis and...
As indeed. You know. I mean, we are all permanently, I mean, naked playing tennis. I mean, just the other day, I mean, it was only 9 degrees. I know, there's a wonderful, funny hedonism, and this marvellous life of these people who have... Some of them who have money, and then you have the Declan O'Hara family, who are all permanently broke.
Despite being very famous and successful.
Being very famous and successful and on the TV. But, you know, his wife is always throwing mad parties and going out buying beautiful dresses and saying, you know, this old thing. And great, great fun. And the only person who's really making any money, apart from Declan with his interviews with the now... working for the now loathed Tony. Taggy is out doing dinner parties that, you know, sometimes go wonderfully well and sometimes go dreadfully wrong. So there's all that going on. Then there's a production of The Merry Widow involving a vast cast of thousands. Then there's everything that's going on in Caridium television. And then when there is this secret rival bid, you get characters in from... Riders, which is great fun.
You get Billy Lloyd Fox and Janie.
Janie Lloyd Fox, and, you know, you've visions of Janie Lloyd Fox sitting down, you know, feeding a baby that is practically breastfeeding a baby that's drinking possibly, you know, neat Bollinger. And it's funny because as a parent, you're sort of going, that's really, really bad. But at the same time, you can read it in a book, and because it's Gilly, it's not real.
Well,
it's funny.
This is the thing about Gilly, and I think. First of all, a lot of women my age are coming to Gilly for the first time. Like, there's the Gilly Cooper book club, which is run by Kat Brown and everything. And
I didn't know how delicious.
She's really coming back. And I think the reason why, obviously it's the glamour and the sex or whatever, but there's become this thing, especially with a kind of social media generation or whatever, which I'm a part of like people interpreting characters' actions in books as direct... As if, like, representing bad characters is commending that behavior, kind of thing. Do you know what I mean?
So,
and people taking people's behavior very literally as being like, oh, people who I'm supposed to like are behaving badly, i.e., cheating on their spouses or whatever. So therefore, the writer must believe that adultery is fine. Therefore, I hate this book. It's a lot of like very literal, quite boring ways of interpreting literature, and I think. That's the reason why Gilly's coming back a bit, because she's someone who just writes like she doesn't give a toss what anyone thinks.
Oh, completely. You know? I mean, she says unbelievable things. And, you know, my point would always be people are very, very complex. You can be a wonderful, marvelously rounded person, and you can still have a husband that you cheat on for the wrong reason. So, you know, and that happens. I think, you know, life is not black and white, is chiaroscuro. It's you know, multicolored. There is the dark and there is the light.
Yeah.
And I think she does that so terribly, terribly well.
And it's why Rupert Campbell Black is this, like, for many people, on a par with Mr. Darcy as being one of the great romantic heroes of all time. Because we meet this person and he is, you know, he bullies, like, Jake Lovell because he's a gypsy, he sees him as being less than. Abominable, you know, and he is cruel to horses. He beats horses and then ships them off. These things that are just like unforgivable. And then we see this, we come to love him. We love him by the end of Rivals, you know.
But you know, I think that's a skill of Gilly's writing, that you see his redemption, but also it's a skill of her, you know, basic psychoanalysis, because you begin to see that he had an absolutely appalling childhood. He may have been absolutely loaded, but he was off, you know, at boarding school from before he could, you know, possibly drink out of a cup on his own. Mm. He always had nannies. His parents were going off marrying other people. They're on their fifth and sixth marriages each. So, you know, he didn't have that basic love. I mean, Nanny is a sort of a martinet in a serge uniform. So you see, you know, it's saying that, you know, you can have all the money in the world, but you can still have a pretty crap upbringing. So it's looking at all sorts of people and saying, yeah, I understand why they behaved that way. And I mean, you know, when he beats that horse, Macaulay, in the first book in Riders, I'm just horrified, because
it's a really devastating scene.
It's absolutely devastating, and you just want to kill him, and you want him to be run over or thrown off the team and forever humiliated. And yet he always is fantastic with his dogs. I'm not saying beat horses, be nice to dogs. That's not what I'm saying at all, as someone who loves horses and has ridden, not for a while though. But, you know, and I mean, I'm a vegetarian. I don't particularly want anything to be hurt. Except anyone who tries to break into my house, and that's a whole different ballgame, or hurt my children. But you learn, you understand him a little bit more, and you see that nobody ever taught him that, yeah, you don't take out your rage on an animal. And do you know, it's interesting, when I was getting ready in the hotel, I flew over yesterday, and I was watching Animal Cops Houston. Oh my God, I had to turn it off.
Animal Cops Houston.
I can't look at any of the...
So are the animals cops? Are they arresting animals?
Yeah, no, what they're doing is they're... And I've seen it on the thingy so many times, you know, when you go in the skybox, and I've never looked at it. And basically it's, you know, sort of like the, you know, RSPCA, ISPCA, going around, set, you know, prosecuting people for abusing animals. Mm. And it's just horrendous. And there are all these fabulous pit bulls that were being used by these criminals, and they were breeding them to fight. And for example, they were breeding white ones because the blood shows really well. And white animals that are bred to be white can quite often go deaf, or maybe this is just a particular genetic thing. I had to actually turn it off because I was sitting there crying. I mean, I can't bear cruelty to animals, and yet I could eventually, because of Gilly's writing and because I could see the redemption of this character, I could understand and go, okay, now I can get that. And that's skill. And the thing about Gilly is huge skill, and I think she is amazing. And I just want to do that sort of Bill and Ted thing, which is going to be lost on another whole other generation. But, you know, we are not worthy.
We are not worthy.
We are not worthy. And when I'm writing a book and I read a Gilly, I go, oh my God, I'm a moron.
Oh, and just the level of, like, it's not even just a, you know, a keen eye for plots or a, you know, a good sort of witty phrase here and there. Like, this is a woman who's, like, classical references go deep.
Yes.
You know?
Like, oh, Catullus, you know, poetry, you know.
Yeats throughout, yeah.
Yeats throughout, exactly. Oh, God, the old Yeats, which is just spectacular. I mean, I have to say, she clearly did have a classical education, and I did not, and I've always tried to sort of make up for it, but I never know how to pronounce Latin.
Same.
Yeah, so this is the problem. Although there's a wonderful line in, I don't know if it's her or somebody else, where somebody says, never tease someone for pronouncing a word incorrectly, because it means they learned it by reading.
Yes.
And I think that is so very, very important. So I would love to know how to pronounce Latin correctly, but I do try, and there's just so many wonderful phrases, and you want to instantly... Actually, I've downloaded Mythos with Stephen Fry.
Oh, yeah, I have that at home, too.
Yes,
yeah.
I know. I love him. He's wonderful. But... you know, to learn more, isn't life every day is a learning experience. Yeah.
I was wondering, I know that your first pick was Riders, but we've already done that with the lovely Jojo Moyes, and Rivals was kind of a second choice, but I'm actually so glad that you're in to talk about Rivals, specifically because it's very exciting to have a fellow Irish guest talk about this book in particular, because Irishness plays such a big part in it. The O'Haras are the kind of central, their house, the Briery, is the centre of all activity. And it's such a loving portrait of, it's always interesting to see Englishness looking at Irishness, for me anyway.
Yeah, no, me too. And it's beautifully, beautifully done. And you could see, I mean, in her acknowledgements, she talks about all the wonderful... You know, she describes the BBC as that great milker of Irish talent.
Yes.
And it's so spectacular because she talks about, you know, Eamon Andrews and Terry Wogan and so many other people, the names of whom are now, of course, escaping my one-time brilliant brain. And it's completely marvellous. And she writes, you know, Declan so amazingly. And she talks about... Yeats and Maud Gonne. So there is this sense that Declan is like Yeats, and he is always in love with Maud Gonne, and his wife is a vision of Maud, and she can hold him by making sure he is never truly sure of her. And then there is this wonderful, wonderful part at the end where he finishes a book and he films it with the spiky production director Cameron, and they go to Lissadel to film.
Yes.
And it's so amazingly done. It's just...
It's very nuanced, and it's clearly... I always, whenever I see, especially a kind of a posh English writer, which Gilly is...
Yes.
When an Irish character comes up, my back goes up. I don't know if yours does.
Because
I'm waiting for the drunkenness, waiting for the ignorance, waiting for the, especially with this time frame when this was written, waiting for the IRA references.
Yes, completely.
Which she's not beyond doing, but there's this like really, I feel like I really know the O'Haras in that they are, you know, big drinkers, messy, love putting on a party, but fiercely intellectual.
Yep.
And they just kind of personify everything that Irish people want to be and how they see themselves as well, I think.
No, I agree completely. And all the good things about, you know, our wonderful country. And yes, I mean, that brilliance, that storytelling, that humour. I mean, the humour of all the members of the family is completely marvellous. I mean, we didn't talk at all about Patrick, who's Declan's son, or Kathleen, who is completely hysterical and has this little witty tongue and
so good.
Loves dogs.
And who Kathleen Moran named herself after.
Oh, my God, really?
So apparently she was Catherine Moran and then read it at 14 and then renamed herself after Kathleen because obviously she saw herself in this witty goth teenager, you know?
And I just love Kathleen Moran. I just think she is completely amazing. I think she's just this, I don't know, beautiful, fresh breath of life into womanhood.
I saw her at a public speaking event this summer, and she is the Jimi Hendrix of public speaking.
Yeah,
honestly, she's like whatever the linguistic version of playing your guitar behind your back.
Oh.
She can do that, you know.
But it's fantastic because she's brought a whole new generation of people to the concept of feminism, when for so long people thought, well, feminism, that's done, you know, we got all that.
Yeah.
And you feel like saying, no, we ain't got all that, actually, you know. It's like that marvellous picture of an elderly woman in the States when Trump was elected, saying with her T-shirt saying, I can't believe I still have to protest this shit, and apologies for using the rude words.
It's no problem at all.
One knows that I never swear. She's laughing
sweetness
a lot
and decency. Sweetness and decency. Speaking of feminism, there's a quite interesting iteration of kind of 80s power feminism in Cameron Cook. What do you make? Because when we meet her, it's quite a cliche. It's like she's got this kind of short, spiky, gelled hair, kind of sharp features, power suits the whole time, shoulder pads the whole time, like snapping at people that she, you know, doesn't need a man, but is, you know, actually quite desperately insecure and lonely. What do you make of that sort of, in the rearview mirror, of that sort of stereotype, now that it's become a stereotype?
Well, I mean, I was around then, and I hate shoulder pads, and no one is ever going to get me to wear them again. And that appeared to be the only way you could get what you wanted, and I was absolutely useless at doing that. And I much prefer the type of feminism where women work together, and I'm very into mentorship and women, I don't know, women coming together. But yeah, that appeared to be the only way you could get it. You had to stand on people. And Cameron stands on people, you know, at a rate of knots, but that was absolutely true of the time. I mean, completely and utterly true of the time. It was, you know, women had to be, excuse the expression, ball busters to get to the top, and they are viewed as such. And yet, the main characters don't see that with her. I mean, she's presented as that on some levels, but the main characters, they don't see that for some reason. I'm explaining this badly, but...
Yeah, no, it's very much... It's kind of... once everyone gets together for the Venturer, which is the name of the TV company, this kind of thing like, oh, you know, Cameron's a pain in the arse, but she's all right kind
of
thing.
Yeah, we're all equal. So Jilly isn't looking at it that way. Her own vision of it isn't that way. She had, because, you know, she had worked in journalism and she had obviously come to her own conclusions about...
Yeah, she's sympathetic as to why Cameron is the way she is, while still being like, this person is hard work.
Yeah, because you had to work twice as hard to get to the same place. And sometimes even if you worked twice as hard, you still didn't get to the same place. And I lived through that. So, yeah, I can understand her. I may have, you know, gone in with sort of a leather jacket on occasionally to sort of look a bit like, okay, I'm tough today. It never lasted, though. I just, and really, that as a concept doesn't work. It's that inner belief and that sisterhood. Yeah, that works.
Mm. It's very much like in the way that kind of sort of very 80s corporate capitalist espionage kind of thing. It's very much a book of its time. And it's what also sort of makes it a book of its time is that there are repeated and quite jarring mentions of AIDS. Did you notice that when you were reading it? Like people being like, there's a bit where Rupert goes and gets an AIDS test and he comes and he's like so relieved. And it's like, it's not like, haha, I thought I might have AIDS. It was like genuine, like I was worried for a minute there.
But that was a huge, huge thing as someone who lived throughout the time, because it was enormous. I mean, when I worked in journalism, we, you know, did big surveys on HIV. We had big, you know, newspaper pullouts on HIV. It was absolutely massive. And, you know, it was the big fear, because for so long, you know, going through the sort of the history of Ireland, it was, you know, pregnancy. Then it, you know, there was, for a while, there was the worst thing that could possibly happen to you was, and I'm not making this up, herpes. And then suddenly AIDS, this absolute plague. And I've just been watching, I'm fascinated by science, and I was supposed to go to the Congo with UNICEF last year, but I ended up, through personal circumstances, not being able to go. But, you know, Ebola has killed roughly 11,000 people in the last couple of years in the DRC area and in Western Africa. And this program, The Hot Zone, is all about the discovery of Ebola and looking at all these viruses that are growing and learning, and HIV was one of them. But because it was so often affecting people who were intravenous drug users or gay people, it was seen as, well, that's their problem. We don't have to worry about it. But Ebola is, you know, affects everyone.
In the context of this novel, it's like, what's interesting about it is that it feels like the end of the party is coming. You know what I mean? It'd be like, we've had these kind of hundreds and hundreds of pages of people just jollily getting off with each other and whatever. And there's this real fear of being like, okay, everyone's been getting off with everybody else's wife and husband for ages. Like, can we do this anymore? You know?
No, there is that. And I don't think, does anyone ever get a condom out?
Never. No.
Never. It's just a curse.
Oh, no, the teenagers do. There's Archie and Caitlin.
Yes, they get a condom out. But nobody else does, because it's like, you know, we can just do whatever we want. So And you can see how, obviously I disagree with this, but you can see how some desperately right-wing fundamentalist Christians were going, now you see what happens when this is Sodom and Gomorrah.
You can understand why they felt they had that leg to stand on. You know?
Yes, exactly. When you really want to say, actually, you know, if you go into the bat cave in Zaire, that's probably where it came from. You know, it's not a, wasn't sent by God at all. But it is interesting. It's a whole different world. You know, pregnancy isn't the big fear. There's something much bigger and more dangerous out there.
Jilli Cooper gets an awful lot of criticism sometimes that she, in her books, anybody who is kind of seen as sort of nouveau riche or an upstart or whatever, is given a very shoddy treatment and is always a kind of ridiculous, quite an almost quite sad character, and they're often quite mean-spirited, and Valerie Jones is a
epitomises that.
But rereading it and knowing that criticism of Cooper, I felt very like, it's not that Jilli Cooper hates the nouveau riche, it's that she hates anybody who's pretending to be something they're not.
Yes, I think she hates two-facedness, really, because, you know, we have Declan O'Hara, whose family are supposed to, his father came from a sheep farm in Wicklow, and then his mother came from Cork. And there was a part of me that did think that was a little tricky now geographically. How did they meet? But anyway, but you know, they came from, his ability to become something different was his talent. It was nothing to do with money or ancestral pictures or anything else. So that was fabulous. And Freddie Jones, this marvelous character. Now, yes, the one thing I sometimes when people's accents are used, I don't like that. That's one thing I don't like, people's accents.
The exact same. So how do you treat accents in your work?
I don't do accents because I think it's just unfair. It's like,
I think it's patronizing. It's condescending. Yeah, and it also assumes that the sort of received English pronunciation of things is the right way of speaking and everything else is a deviation.
Yes, completely. So I don't do accents. So, you know, it just seems wrong to do it. And I don't, it can be, you know, the way she does it can be terribly funny. But, you know, Freddie Jones, it's sort of, that jars slightly with me. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that. But I think that is very much of the time when you write. It's like Keith Waterhouse wrote a book called Bimbo, which was absolutely hilarious. Oh, God, I don't know, 80s, 90s. And it was about even the name Bimbo. Mm-hmm. So it is this version of a, you know, totally fiction, page 3 sort of model girl who is suddenly catapulted to fame because she had a fling with some, I don't know, I can't remember if he's an MP or he's a desperately rich man, and it all comes out, and it's, so this is her story, but it's written all in sort of the, in patois or, you know, and
dialect, I
suppose. Yes, and it's terribly funny, but it, you know, I look at, we'll say,
It's quite different than when you see like Irvine Welsh doing the same thing, because he's of that community.
Exactly. So you can do it then, but I just don't think it works otherwise. And yet then I look at Anita Loos, who wrote, you know, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and you've got Lorelei, and she doesn't, I'm just trying to remember, she doesn't write.
It's diary entries, so it's written in a way that someone like that would write. But then that's kind of a judgment in itself, isn't it?
Yes,
so
I know.
It's quite hard to know where the line is.
I don't know. I don't know where the line is.
It comes down to comfort when you're reading it, and if you feel like there's a nastiness of intent there. Whereas I feel like Lorelei is quite an affectionate portrayal of a really ridiculous person.
I know, but like a darling, and you just love her, and she's just, but just silly.
And like literally kills people.
Yes, completely. Which is deliciously silly, and you know, you completely love her. But that's, that sort of dialect thing would be the only thing I don't like in Jilli, but no, I do think she's marvellous. But you know, a couple of years ago, somebody went out to her house and did a huge interview, and Jilli was lovely and had her in her house and, you know, cooked lunch for her and was fabulous to her. And then the most savage piece was written about this.
Really?
And I found myself thinking, you know what, that's really just sort of, let's see, who we take a hit on today. I find that very annoying.
Yeah.
You know, it's like giving a book to review to somebody who is going to loathe and abhor it and is just going to eviscerate the person. Yeah. I say, really, why do that?
Have you ever had that experience with a review where you looked at the reviewer and being like, well, that was the kind of person that was never going to buy this book anyway. You give that? I've had that once or twice where I'm like...
Oh, yeah. Oh, completely. And you just sort of go... Actually, the great thing about having written so many books is you just get to the point where you go, whatever. Maybe they were having a bad day. Maybe they are full of rage. Maybe they have a novel in a drawer. And you just have to move on because, you still want to give them time in your head because that's really like, you know, what's that old thing about poison, you know? Revenge is like making poison and drinking it yourself.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
To get back to the main like romance of the book, the sort of Taggy and Rupert thing, and we talked about the kind of problematic age gap or whatever. But again, one of those things it just didn't bother me at all, and I think possibly because what was very interesting about it, and you have this character Taggy, who is this wonderful person who likes to look after people, and it also has that kind of foisted on her by her sort of mad, irresponsible family, who can't really read because of dyslexia and I imagine other learning difficulties by the sounds of it.
Dyspraxia.
Yeah. And meeting this man who is so kind of worldly and so has been everywhere and has kind of had this very intellectual first wife and now has this very intellectual girlfriend and feeling like she can sort of never compete. And that's, I kind of love the idea of like, after seeing so many kind of sparky women quoting Shakespeare and like knowing Bach, to be just this woman who just like, it feels very sort of counter feminist or whatever, to be like, she's just someone who loves animals and loves being at home and wants to look after people. For her to be the romantic hero again feels like, it's like quite, I don't know, it feels like a kickback to another time, but also felt quite modern, you know?
But you know what, it was modern. I think in a way it just worked, and I could be totally wrong here, for the story she had to be a certain age. I often feel that when I read it, in that she had to be a certain age, and yet she had worked in somebody's restaurant in Soho for 2 years.
Yeah, so she'd been kicked out of school. She'd left school at like 15. Yeah. So she'd already lived a life of sorts.
Yeah, so she had. So, and this guy said, look, I can't teach her anymore. And, you know, she could be the next Escoffier. So obviously she has, you know, plenty of experience in this world. But in this other world that her family lives in, this intellectual world, she is, you know, a fish out of water. But it doesn't mean that she is in any way
lesser.
Stupid. Yeah, or lesser. And I think it just worked that she had to be that age to fit in with the plot and the age of Declan and Maud and the other kids. So I often think that was a part of it, and therefore the fact that there is this 19-year age gap, which makes Rupert go away and go, I can't possibly do this because she's, you know, far too young or whatever. But I don't feel, you don't feel the sense that she is actually a true 18 or 19-year-old. You actually don't feel that. Because I think...
Because she's got this adolescent mother, so she's sort of like looking...
Yeah, so she has been the one who has been the grown-up all along. She has basically raised her younger sister. Mm. So,
and she's getting ready for school every term and all this.
Yeah, she gets her ready for school. She does all this stuff. So she's the person who's been the parent in so many parts of the family. So she's not your average 18-year-old. So I don't think it's harking back in that way. But somebody says something marvellous in the book in that... you know, actually what Rupert needs is some woman who's going to think he's amazing and fantastic, because he's really streetwise, but he's not an intellectual, because he, you know, wasn't interested in school, wasn't interested in, you know, the classics, and, you know, keeps pronouncing, Yeats. And she doesn't know how to pronounce it either, but she probably does because of her father. So, you know, it works well together.
And what's lovely is that there's this thing at the end of the book, which is a spoiler, but where there's like a tell-all printed about him in the paper about all his many affairs and all the terrible things he's done. And she sort of shows up at the airport and she's like, I can't read them.
Yeah, I know.
And it's kind of sounds lovely.
It, no, it just works. And she's written his name incorrectly.
Phonetically, yeah.
It's phonetically because she doesn't know. And it's just... it's just absolutely spectacular. And she's not without her admirers, and there are plenty of them, because she is very, very beautiful. And you just get a sense that, yes, that, you know, this is meant to be. And yeah. I don't know if I think it's a throwback to, you know, I mean, she's not Lizzie Bennet, but she's strong, very strong in her own way. Her weakness is perhaps her heart having broken because she thinks he has gone off her. But I think loving animals desperately, I think there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong at all.
There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I put the spiders outside. I mean, if there was any sort of cockroachy thing, okay, that'd be dead. I put the spiders outside and do all that sort of carry on and write beetles. You know, there's, you know, do you know those little beetles that look very bluey and you sometimes see them and I sort of twirl them over and they line their backs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I sort of twirl them over and go, off you go now.
Off you go now.
And it's just sort of cute because we need them. We need them. And I pet bees as well.
Pet them?
Well, you know, you see them and they're there, the lavender or they're, you know, the catmint, and you just get them and you can just give them a little pet on the back because they know. I mean, they have such their ability to sense pheromones, and they know I'm not, you know, a dreadful threat to them. And we need them. I mean,
you're like St. Francis of Assisi.
Sure, this is me altogether now.
Living in a cave.
Living in a cave, I know. Well, my brother is called Francis, but yes, I love them. Yeah, but as I said before, you can keep the cockroaches away. I don't like them.
Can I tell you my one pet peeve about animals in Julie Cooper? And it's happened in both books now. Jack Russells are never named. Have you noticed that?
That is true, actually.
So I'm...
yes.
I have Jack Russell. I'm crazy about her. Her name is Sylvie, Jilly. And she always says, Beaver the Lurcher, or yes, Blue the Thing, Blue. and then several Jack Russells. I'm like, name the fucking Jack Russells!
Do you know what? I'm with you on that as a woman who has three Jack Russells.
And what are their names?
Their names are Licky, Dinky, and Scamp.
And lovely.
They are my little darlings, and I am their pack mother, and they lie on me and at night, and it's very hard. So I sometimes have to say, can someone change the channel because I have dogs on me?
Oh my, well, you've heard that famous quote from Jilly's husband, haven't you?
Yes, yes.
What does your wife wear to bed?
Dogs.
Mostly.
Yes, yes. I love that. It's just fantastic. Oh yeah, no, dogs. So what would we do without our animals, our fur babies, be it dogs, cats. I'm a godmother to two hamsters. One of my nieces has hamsters, so I'm a godmother.
What an honor. What privilege.
I know, they're gorgeous. Actually, this is the second time I've been a godmother to a hamster. Not everyone appreciates hamsters. But
no, I don't. No. Every time, we always try to smuggle kind of rodent-adjacent pets into the house. Oh, and my dad would always kill them.
Yeah, but you see, a lot of people, to them, they're just rodents. And also, you couldn't have them with Jack Russells, because you know that you'd need a defibrillator for dogs or for little rodenty things, and I don't think they come in that size.
So what does how do you function as a godparent to a hamster? Do you
you send there are two of them, and you send them lovely little, you know, extra wheelie things and yolks and food and nice things. Amazon is amazing.
It's mostly about being a spiritual guide to them, though, I think.
A spiritual guide and going, I think this is wonderful, because right now you can't have a dog, so you need to have something to love and adore, and I get that.
I get it too. I just want to move out of London so I can just have a home for retired terriers, you know? All I want to do. I don't really want to have children. I just want to be someone who just is constantly loading six dogs in and out of a car, you know?
I know, but that's completely beautiful, because we show parenthood in so many ways, you know? Where is this thing coming from that says you must have children. Not everyone wants children, and for some people their beautiful animals are it. I had a beautiful Labrador called Tamsin. She was my familiar. And
right.
I say that, and anyone with a problem with that, go look it up and then come back and talk to me about it. My beautiful baby. I still haven't grieved her totally, because I think I would just break down totally for about 4 months. But yeah, they're just beautiful. Since I was three, we had dogs, and they've always been my special friends.
Dogs. Dogs. The rivals, dogs.
Rivals. Well, they're very intertwined. They're intertwined. Jilly loves her animals, and that comes through. And you know,
I do love that when Cameron leaves Rupert at the end, she takes Blue.
She takes Blue, you see. They're always there.
Yeah. So before we start crying about dogs, you've got a wonderful new book out called The Family Gift. Tell me a little bit about it.
Oh, so far I've been resting my coffee and my bracelets on it, so I wouldn't rattle too much. I know. It is the story of... Actually, people keep saying... Somebody said yesterday, my heroine is very tall and has naturally blonde hair and is a fabulous cook. And people keep saying, is this now a bit of wish fulfillment? Because I am 5 foot, my hair is quite dyed. And
I'm writing a character at the moment who's sort of a former model and glamour girl, and I was like, wish fulfillment.
But we do. You see, that's it. And people say, is it a real person? And you go, no, it's just the person I might like to be.
Yeah.
And then when I talk about how I can't cook, people, well, no, I do. I mean, I cook all the damn time. I mean, because I have a husband and I've got two sons, and I mean, you know, at least with the dogs, it's quite easy to do the dog food.
Oh yeah.
But you know, it's just every day. If it was just me, I think I'd just live off cheese sandwiches. But anyway, so we have beautiful Freya, and she is, well, she's not beautiful, but, you know, she's interesting, and she wouldn't be into the makeup much, and she's sort of a big blast of eyeliner, so she looks like she didn't take it off from the night before, and she ties her hair in a plait. And I got great advice from the lovely Catherine Fulvio, who at the time was nominated for an Emmy on daytime TV. And I mean, Emmy! For God's sake, sure, I would be delirious. Now, sadly, she did not win, but there are beautiful pictures of her all glammed up. So, anyway, Freya has moved into this new house, and her husband is Dan, but he was married before, and his first wife, Alyssa, and he had a baby. And Alyssa... They split up, and Alyssa got the baby, Lexi, and she was a pretty appalling mother, and so she still thought she was a sort of an it girl, if that is still an expression, possibly not.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous girl around town, and eventually, you know, left the baby behind in a restaurant. So at that point, Dan and his new girlfriend, Freya, stepped in and said, we're going to raise the child, and she is then adopted by Freya. So Freya now has three children, one of whom is Lexi. Something bad happens to Freya, and she's dealing with that. Alyssa, the ex-wife, comes back and sort of says, I want to see my little girl again, who is 14, and is interested in now this sort of glamorous, you know, woman who we can all see, you know, possibly should be hit over the head with a big book.
Mm.
But, you know, to a 14-year-old, seeing someone, you know, an adult with an Instagram account and, you know, a deal to sell fake tan, she seems very exciting. Mm. And then there's lots of trauma going on in Freya's family of origin. So it's all falling apart, and Freya is the person who minds everyone. So she can't tell what's really going on in her heart because of this incident that happened to her. And it's about how she copes, and it's about letting go, perhaps, not always trying to be the one in charge. And what happens when she gets stuck and she can't write any more recipes, and watching her beloved daughter sort of move away from her. And and she has an inner voice called Mildred.
Yes, I was wondering when you're going to bring up Mildred.
Yeah, you see, Mildred seems like such a part of life, really. I mean, I think everyone must have a Mildred, that inner voice that says, you know, you're not really going out in that, are you? Or you know, that article is dreadful, you just moron. Or, you know, no one's going to like that book. Really, they're going to say, that book is dreadful. And so she, her inner voice really kicks up a notch with this incident, and Mildred, you know, she thinks giving the name, the inner voice, the inner critic, a name will sort of lessen the power, but not really. But she can talk back to her, you know, and she can say, Mildred, shut up. And it's fun. It's different in that it's written in the first person, and I've never done that before.
Have you not?
No, I haven't. I've always written in the third person. So,
and what are you finding of the challenges of that? Or were the challenges of that?
It was much easier. It was fantastic. Yeah. Although I used to sort of get stuck on tense occasionally. But,
okay, so I'm doing the other way around at the moment. I've written three novels in first person, and now I'm doing the fourth one in third person, and I'm finding the tenses a nightmare.
It's just a switch.
Yeah.
You get used to it.
I keep going from third person past to third person present, and it's just, I feel like I'm back in school, honestly. My confidence is shot from it.
No, well, I was exactly the same. And you'd be there going, what? And you'd read the bit and you go, I must be a complete moron. The word moron comes into my sentence a lot. I sort of self-castigate. I used to have a system whereby I'd write a bit on my computer and I go, that's dreadful, and then I would, you know, delete it. Now I just think it, and
it's
much more
economical
to do it that way. So so that's it, and there's a lot of humour in it. Marion Keyes was saying to me, she said, your emails are hysterical, she said, you know, I'm not getting enough of that in this book. And I said, right, to be more of me. So,
well, that's a great sort of challenge to get, though.
I know.
If you're already a funny person.
I know. I love Marion, and she's good.
She's wonderful.
She's wonderful. So there we are now. So that's the new book with added madness and fun.
It's like about what all my favourite things are about, which is people who are just trying their best.
Yeah.
You know? That's failing. My favourite genre. You know what I mean?
Yeah, me too. And failing a lot of the time. And maybe not failing, but, you know, being held up to mad standards. And it's also about the fakeness of social media, because she's a TV chef, she feels she's going to be doing this. I'm doing this. It's fabulous. Woo! You know, cooking.
And that's very analogous to the sort of life of the author, isn't it, really? Of having to be everything I do is fabulous. Please go buy the book. Yeah. All good bookshops now. La, la, la. When inside you're like, this is a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Because I wrote it and I'm a piece of shit.
Completely. and then followed up by, actually, now I have to go to Tesco's. And that's why wearing glasses. It's a pity that this isn't visual. People can see I have sort of big dark glasses.
They're lovely.
They're fabulous, though, because it means that really you don't need to wear a lot of makeup. Now, I am wearing a lot of makeup today, but you don't need to wear a lot of makeup because your eyes are so hidden. So they're brilliant.
Right.
And it's fantastic. So I can just whack on the glasses, you know,
gives you a sense of a sort of authority and presence.
A sense of authority and presence, exactly. Yeah. And bit of lip gloss, I'm out the door, down to Tesco's to buy a toilet roll. You know, so like the life of glamour is just me.
Well, the first time I met you was extremely glamorous. Do you remember when we met?
This was at the Book Awards.
Yes, the Irish Book Awards. And and I remember you came up to me because we were both wearing suits.
Yes.
Yes.
And see, I love wearing a suit.
I feel so powerful when I'm in a suit. I feel like Cameron Cook.
I completely. And I've decided that I'm not going to wear a dress to any more of these things.
Me neither.
That's it. And I've started following this wonderful thing on Instagram called The Cut. And they're based in Belfast. And they make suits. And I keep going, one of these days I'm going to go up. Because I am, you know, short. And I occasionally buy those bras for, you know, decreasing the size of your bazoo.
Yes, yes. Next, do a brilliant one.
Yeah. Next, do they do
next,
a good
do
one?
A fantastic strapless bra, yeah, for big boobs.
Suck them all in. Yeah. Okay. And you see, so it can be quite, you know, tricky to get the proportions right. So keep thinking, I'm going to go up there one of these days when a nice big check comes in, and I'm going to say, I want a suit that makes me feel powerful and marvellous, and then I'm going to wear it till it falls off. And
my dream. Suits. And then you came up to me because I had just I just lost an award.
I know. So hard.
And you came up to me and you just like spread your arms out in your beautiful suit and you're just like, they never give me anything either, but I'm laughing all the way to the bank.
Did I get that?
And I was what a flipping legend. I'll cut that out if you don't like it, but I was like, what an absolute G.
Do you know what? And we got this out too. I've been going to those awards for possibly 18 years, never won anything. And you know what? It's like, do you know what? Asher.
It's Asher.
Asher. And you know what? It's fabulous because you get to meet the lovely people. I mean, it's so glorious. And I love meeting new, young, wonderful writers. The number of new, young, wonderful writers I've met, and then we have emails, and I'm always saying, I must get emails, and I must get your email.
Oh, lovely.
Just so, you know, we can talk because we are powerful.
We're a lot. We should leave it there because that's a fantastic place to leave it. Thank you so much, Kathy Kelly. You are a fabulous guest and one of the most entertaining people I've ever met. And I would listen to you talk about bees all day.
Blathering. I'm a desperate blatherer, as they say at home. I think they tune out. Thank you so much, Caroline.
The family gift, everyone get it. It's a bloody delight. Thank you, and so are you.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.